Jason won that match against Shane, and Shane's a king, and he went up and stood in his chair. You don't stand in the king's chair.
After 2 weeks of basically nothing in the pool world, we have just an excess of pool this week. We get two different big matchups, but we're going to keep you in suspense on what they are because that's what we do here. Hi, Demetrius. Hi, Rob.
What's going on, Nate?
Nate Mindum.
That's my name.
So how the heck are you? Another week?
Yeah, another week. And
we're all still here?
Yes, we are all still here, just narrowly. The coronavirus almost got me over Facebook Live with all the Facebook Lives I've been doing lately.
As long as they don't stop you from fishing.
Well, you
as long as they can go down to the river and stand on the bank and fish.
Can't give up fishing.
I mean, I don't think that's pretty safe.
Seemingly.
You don't get closer than 6 feet to another guy unless you're at De Pere over on the Fox River in Green Bay.
Yeah. Well, I guess we can kind of jump in. I will make a couple of announcements in the beginning, just like normal. So the Patreon money for the podcast this month, I always like to give updates on what I'm actually doing with that. I bought a webcam setup for the GoPro. So I didn't realize that what I needed was backordered when I ordered it. So I don't know when I'm supposed to get it because there's no date on it. But I will be basically setting up a much more professional webcam for all the Facebook Lives that I'm doing so that I'm not using my webcam on my HP Pavilion computer. It seems like a more professional quality camera would be a pretty good investment if I'm going to continue doing these Facebook Lives in the near future. So that is what I will be upgrading the podcast with this month. So just figured I would throw that out there. I gave the hint for the Facebook Lives. I just did one recently with Emily. So if you, for whatever reason, did not see that on Facebook, I did a Facebook Live with Emily Frazier. And you can head over there because it is still on the page. And I also did one with Rodney Morris. And full disclosure, it is the 6th of April today. Tomorrow, I will be doing another one, probably actually by the time that this gets out, it'll actually probably be after that interview, but it'll be there. And it'll be with Emily Frazier and Roy from Roy's Basement. And there may or may not be a couple special guests that are going to be joining that. So it'll be worth watching, I think. But that'll be tomorrow, the 7th. And then I have one more idea, and I wouldn't mind you guys jumping in for this to tell me if I'm crazy or if this might be a decent idea in the future. But I was talking on Facebook with Willie Ewings, and we were just basically chatting about the Moscone Cup, and he's going to be joining the podcast's group for the tickets for the Moscone Cup. And I should say that if you didn't see this, I put a post out on Facebook. I'm going to try and get a section of the Moscone Cup, the stands, to have just a queue it up section. So maybe we'd have 15, 20 people. Maybe we'd have three. Maybe we'd have 40. Who knows? Where basically if you're a listener to the podcast and you want to go to the Moscone Cup, we could all sit together. And I talked to Emily Frazier and they will work it out to where we can get a section together. So I think that'd be a really, really fun idea. But I was talking to Willie about this and it kind of just formed into chatting about the Atlantic Cup and basically trying to find a way to get the American youth players there. The European youth players, I think, are just infrastructurally, they're so much more well off than the American youth players. It just seems like Europe is way more structured to be able to really support their youth players, whether it's organizations or whether it's just having better opportunities at youth tournaments. They have, you know, youth tournaments all over Europe, and there's really, really none available, or at least not many available in the U.S. So we were kind of talking that it might be a really, really cool idea to try to find a way to get all of the Atlantic Cup qualifiers to the Moscone Cup to be able to watch. And from that, it kind of just spawned into an idea of trying to set up a nonprofit, something like that, that actually works towards supporting the Atlantic Cup qualifying players for the U.S. to kind of give them some support in some ways. And not only to get to the Moscone Cup every year, because I think that would be extremely influential. Plus, they're going to be playing, a lot of those kids are actually really probably going to be playing in that anyway. So, you know, get them a taste of what it's like, get them in that environment so that the first time that maybe they're going to the Moscone Cup and, you know, they're not playing in it. So they can actually have a little bit of a prepping thing to the environment of what that's like. What do you guys think? Do you think that's a crazy idea to set up some sort of nonprofit to try to help out some of the youth players?
It's a worthy cause for sure. I agree with you. You know, we've got it's given young players the opportunity to run. And of course, I'm coming from a really, really biased perspective because I had a ton of fire in the belly when I was 12, 13, and there was just not a lot of road available to me, you know, and it was kind of difficult. It was a big pain point. Like I said before, I'm really glad how things played out, but I was definitely, all I wanted was somebody to give me an opportunity, somebody to, you know, whether it was somebody to mentor me or somebody to expose me to high level pool or somebody to take me under their wing or take me to tournaments or just give me, I mean, I tried to manufacture it myself just through the sheer desire, but it was a very, very difficult thing to do as a young kid on my own. And so when I see some of the passionate young players in the game that are just, that they just want it more than anything in the world, and they're practicing and they're competing and they're doing drills and they're watching top players. And then they're just kind of like, it's almost like they're dying on the vine, and that's a pretty sad thing. And so to give somebody the opportunity to get out there and experience pro pool up close and personal and the adrenaline of that environment, that's a very worthy cause. So.
Well, the cause for this, you can't deny it's got a purpose to it for sure. I remember back when I was a kid, they didn't have tournaments.
Just yeah, it was the
a couple
same for me.
Professional tournaments a year. So if you were a young guy trying to make your way in pool, you had to take a bus to like a big city and just play the best player in the city. That kind of stuff. So yeah, this would be great news for a lot of young guys. Great exposure.
Yeah, I think
if you did something like this, your name would be etched in pocket pool history, Nate.
Well, this is, I guess, transitioning to what I was about to say. This is something that I literally have no experience. I mean, I feel like everything that I do with the podcast, I literally have no idea what I'm doing. I just kind of feel around in the dark until I find a light switch. And I guess I'm reaching out using the podcast platform here for some light switches. If anybody has any ideas on how to get this started, I know it's going to take a lot of legal paperwork. If by some amazing feat of luck, we have a lawyer that listens to this podcast and wants to somehow help out, either, you know, maybe volunteering time or maybe working out some sort of deal where we could set this up for a little bit cheaper.
That's a pool player that listens to this podcast.
Yeah.
How many listeners are there to the podcast? I have no idea.
Yeah, or if any
couple thousand?
Yeah, something like that. Or if anybody knows a lawyer who's a pool player or passionate about the game and wants to help out in some sort of way. I mean, this is going to be I have to set it up as a nonprofit because it's got to be something that's going to be sustainable, and it's got to be something that if I ever don't have the time to work with, the infrastructure is in place already to continue on the work that I set up. I shouldn't say I set up because Willie even volunteered to help out. So we're going to need some volunteers along the way to really help me form this. So if you are a listener to the podcast, you are already maybe involved with some youth programs, or maybe you just want to help out in small ways by, you know, I don't know, donating an hour or two a week to help me organize some stuff. This is going to be set up, I hope, by this coming December so that we could actually get to some youth players out to London for the Moscone Cup there, if it's possible. Again, I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm going to be kind of feeling around in the dark, trying to figure some stuff out. So if anybody else out there has more information and is willing to help with this, I think it'd be a really, really, really neat idea to help the youth players in the U.S. kind of catch up to some of the opportunities that the European youth players have too. And on top of the Moscone Cup idea right now, but I think it could branch into actually helping them other opportunities as well. So that's the ultimate goal, is to use this as an opportunity to help out in other ways too.
You sold me, buddy. I'll even volunteer to help you.
Wow. We can't get you to listen to the podcast, but we can get you to donate some of your time.
Yes, you can.
That's awesome, Rob. That's such a sweet thing of you. You watch
two this week. I just want you to know, Nate.
Oh, we don't want to talk about that. The ghost kicked my butt. You know.
No, it wasn't the ghost. It was it was when you were explaining what balls to pick.
Oh, you watched that video of me playing patterns.
I watched that video. Yes, of you giving your opinion at what balls to pick.
Oh well,
I watched one game.
Well, that's neat. Did you learn anything?
I wouldn't have shot the same first shot you shot.
Well, that's the fun part about it, right?
After that, I just kind of sat back and I thought, okay, now I'll just see how many mistakes he makes after this.
Did I run out of that rack?
You're a good enough player where you're probably, that rack was pretty easy. You're going to get out of that rack even if you shoot the wrong ball every shot. with low balls in that rack, I was looking at it going, yeah, Nate, you could probably pick the wrong ball every shot.
You know, I've watched a lot of pro pool and on YouTube, and there's always one guy in the comments that's talking about how they don't play that good. I always wondered who that was, but apparently we just found it, huh, Nate?
Hey.
Wow. That's funny.
That's a good time. Well, Rob, it's nice that you're actually starting to participate with the podcast, or at least, you know, consuming some of the content. Well, I'll stop picking on you for a week now. But so that's all the announcements I have for clearing up in the beginning. I have a lot of other things that I would like to talk about, but I don't think it's super important for right now. So we'll push it off for a couple weeks. So why don't we jump into shout outs? And I will go first because I always make you two go first. So I will go first. And this past week, I did I should start this 2 weeks ago. I did a special on t-shirts, and I'm trying to kind of wean out my t-shirts because I bought a lot of t-shirts expecting that I would have a couple of state tournaments. I had my one booth that I had at one tournament, and I was going to have another booth at another pool tournament that was canceled because of the coronavirus. So I have a pretty big stock of t-shirts right now, a lot more of a stock than I would like to have. So I've been trying to do some specials and just find ways of kind of like weaning out the product that I have, the swag that I have right now. So I have a lot of towels and I have a lot of t-shirts. So 2 weeks ago I ran a special on t-shirts and that went like super well. It went really, really, really well. I sold a bunch of them and it was really, really nice. I got rid of, I think, like 35 t-shirts. I think I ended up getting rid of 35 t-shirts and I ended up sending another, I think 10 or 15 to Roy for Roy's Basement. And, actually got a couple pictures of Pia and Joshua wearing a queued up t-shirt. So that was kind of neat. But so I tried another one of those this week and I put it out there, for a towel and a t-shirt and a patch for, $40 and shipping and a shout out to the podcast. So that was what you got for, that price. And I had three people get it. So I really want to thank Austin Hill, Tim Clark, and Benjamin Young for supporting the podcast and, you know, doing that special and helping me kind of get rid of some of the product that I'm sitting on. I mean, I guess it's already paid for at this point, but I have a lot of overhead worth of swag that I was hoping to get rid of at some of the state tournaments at booths. So I'm glad that I'm still able to get rid of some of that with your guys' support. So thanks so much for you guys for doing that. And yeah, that's my shout out is those three people.
They're great t-shirts.
They are, right?
They're really comfortable.
Rob, would you like to go next?
Yeah, I'm going to do a future shout out. And this is to all the listeners out there, no matter what country you're listening from or what language you want to shout out in yourself. This is a progressive shout out. In other words, this week and next week, if everybody that's listening, every podcast viewer out there, if you just mention pool to somebody this week, you call up a friend, call up a family member. If you can't go visit them or you don't think you should, you're in an area that's contaminated with the virus. You know, ask somebody about pool, anybody. They don't even have to be somebody who plays pool. It could be a family member that's even not interested, your wife, brother, sister, father, whatever, and or a pool playing friend. Just shout out to them in recognition of the Cue It Up podcast. Call it this week it'll be the Cue It Up podcast personal shout outs. That's my shout out to you. If you do that, I'm shouting out to you this week for a future shout out of your own.
Whoa, that's inception. That's deep stuff right there. But I like it.
I thought about that idea for like 3 days.
And it's cool. You could ask maybe your local best player or maybe your parents' player or something like that. Yeah. Ask a story from somebody who's 60 plus. They love to tell stories, right, Rob?
Well, they usually have quite a few of them. I know we were mentioned what you do for the young pool player. What can we do as a podcast for these up and coming players and get them involved in the pool community, get them overseas to the Moscone Cup? I'm all behind you on that for sure. When I was a kid, I used to take my pool cue with me when I'd get my braces tightened and take the bus over to Duluth. I'd get a school pass to get out and get my teeth fixed. And I'd take my cue with me so I could play the best player in Duluth, Minnesota, after I got my braces tightened. And as long as I got out of school anyhow. might as well shoot a little pool and learn a little something.
Yeah, right.
So I'd go over to Duluth when I was 14, and lose all my weekly allowance and any other money I had, just to learn how to play.
Hey,
and then take the bus back home.
Got to learn something, right?
I would like to shout out to Ross. I think it's Copperhead. I'm not looking at his last name. But Ross Coppert from North Dakota, you know, he messaged me and he had a really good question. And unfortunately, I won't be able to get to this question tonight, but I will get to it next time because I thought it was a really good one, which is how do you stay focused and engaged when you're playing weaker players or when you're practicing on your own? He's, a lot of times he starts off really strong. And then after winning a few games or beating his opponent soundly for a little while, you know, it's kind of hard to keep that same level of intensity. And so he wanted my thoughts on that. And anyway, we had a really good conversation. I'm excited to share some of what we talked about next week. So make sure you tune back in to a Cue It Up podcast. So anyway, I really like it. You know, podcasts are weird because they're one-way transmissions, at least for me. And so when you guys reach out and message us and ask us questions and things like this, it makes this from a radio show into a community, and that's what we're looking for. So thank you.
I cannot echo that statement anymore. All parts of it, but especially the community part. We're not trying to build like I'm not trying to build a platform where, like the Joe Rogan Experience, for example, since I get compared to that so often. Joe Rogan has, correct me if I'm wrong, if either you listen, I don't really listen very, very often, but he has no basically contact with his listeners at all. And that's not how I want the podcast to be. I want to be able to engage with everybody who listens to the podcast as much as possible or as much as I'm able to and you're willing to. So that's why we're setting up watch parties and we are, we're asking for listener questions. I really should probably go about doing that a little bit more. And I actually thought I had an idea, which I'll incorporate this into right here maybe. Rob and I have been doing the two tips now for, Rob, what do you think, maybe 6 or 7 months?
At least, yeah. Almost from the onset of the podcast.
Yeah, it was
within 2 months after we started.
Yeah, we started it very, very soon. And it's not that, I could still come up with plenty of things that we could talk about any given week, and I would be happy to do that. I mean, but I was starting to think that maybe instead of a two tip segment, maybe we could do a listener's fan question where we get a listener's, but this is going to require listeners to write in with their questions, but we could take on one of their questions every single week and we could talk about different viewpoints on it and things that, I'm sure we'll agree for the most part, at least on a broad scale, but we might have different intricacies about things that we would, you know, optimize about it, or, you know, there's a lot of room for agreement and disagreement with a lot of really in-depth, thoughtful questions. So maybe in the near future, depending on if we get some listeners to reach in with questions, whether it's to me personally, Demetrius, Rob, anybody personally, or through the podcast page or through the website too at queuitupodcast.com. You can always send your questions through there too. And I think that'd be a fun way of transitioning the two tip segment into maybe a listener's question that we could address every week. What do you guys think about that?
I would love it.
Yeah, that's good. We talked about that 6 months ago, Nate. What I'm getting is it pop-ups on my Facebook. Queue It Up is automatically, when I go on my Facebook page, I have, you know, a list of all the comments. And the comments can be questions also from folks making comments about the podcast. And yeah, they could ask questions too, whatever.
For sure.
You know, and there's at least a dozen every time I go on Facebook there.
Yeah, and we've been getting more and more engagement on the posts. We've been getting more and more engagement on the YouTube videos, the live videos that I've been doing, and then just the podcast posts that I put out there. So, you know, I think 6 months ago we tried this, and I don't think we had enough of a listener base to be able to do this. And I'm hesitant to think that we will even now still, but I think we're closer to being on that range where we could have a sustaining flow of questions that are coming in that we could talk about every week. So we can just leave it there. And if the listeners think that this would be a good idea and you would like to have your questions answered by Demetrius, myself, and Rob, feel free to reach out and we'll, you know, maybe we'll just transition two tips slowly out and we'll do, you know, one listener question every 2 weeks or every 3 weeks or whenever they're available. And we'll slowly transition out as it gets more and more popular. I think that'd be a good idea. But I guess that clears up all the shout outs and all the initial announcements in the beginning. So we can jump into all of the amazing content that happened in the last week. Did you guys get all that? Did you get all that? All the stuff that happened? It was a lot.
I mean, I practiced a little bit at home. It was a good time.
I played the ghost. We could talk about that. I got my face kicked in.
I'll tell you, I actually did one thing that I'm surprised I've never done this before. But I've got the whiteboard by my pool table, which, man, that's handy. And what I was doing is I was playing straight pool. And what I did is I'm like, you know, sometimes when I'm practicing by myself, I could post up some occasional good runs, but I also have sometimes when I'm practicing where, kind of speaking to what I was saying before, it's hard to get into it sometimes. And I find myself, you know, for a guy that can run some big numbers at times, I also have my days where I can't hardly get into the second rack because I'm just kind of like not really focused or anything. So like what I decided to do was I was going to see how many innings it took me to get to 100 points. You know, does it take me 10 innings? Does it take me one run? Does it take me five runs? Like, how many runs does it take me? I'm going to play until I get to 100 points. And each time I miss or whatever, each time my run ends, I'm going to write which inning it was, how many balls I ran, and then I'm going to write out why my run ended. You know, did I miss get out of line? Did I miss a hard shot? Did I miss an easy shot? Did I scratch off a break? Like, whatever. Whatever. What was the reason for my inning to end? And so I did that several times here over the last week. And man, I didn't post any huge runs. Okay. I didn't break 100, but it's like all of a sudden I went from like not really being into it to all of a sudden I started running some, you know, I don't like name drop or whatever it would be, but I started posting up some reasonable runs and starting to run some balls and it was really satisfying. So anyway, that was my week of nothing, but anyway, just a fun little, I guess I had some fun. I don't mind quarantine as long as I have a pool table.
Yeah. Well, you kept the numbers. I think that in itself is a purpose other than just practice. Well, I'm going to go practice. Well, yeah, you got to have a purpose.
Well, anyway, yeah, really. I normally do. And, you know, I normally practice. What I usually do is I practice certain things for a while, but then I also like to have a chance to just play to kind of make sure I keep my rhythm and kind of put it all together. And anyway, you know what? This is just proof that I can find. I can talk about nothing, so keep going, Nate.
No, there is something to that, though, and it's a broader point. You're kind of using it as like a like a more of like a defined example of it. But what
absolutely, yeah, it's like when I do three cushion at home, I have a scorer, I have a flip chart scorer, and when I practice shots, specific shots, I just keep shooting them. I don't use that, but then there's a time I want to see what my average could be at trying as hard as I can try. And so that's what that's for. And it's a different way to focus. It's a different way to learn.
Tell you the stupidest thing. I think it's illegal, so I probably shouldn't say this, but I used to tear up money. I had $1 bills. It's surprising, even if it's only a dollar, it's really, really hard to tear up money because it's like, it's just such a stupid thing to do. So I had a stack of $1 bills, and if I didn't do certain things, I'd have to go tear up a dollar bill. And even though it's only a dollar, it's just painful to have to do. And so anyway, I probably only did, like, you know, in my entire time of trying that out, I probably tore up like $5 or $10. It wasn't anything substantial. But anyway, I was, the point is I've gone through a number of experiments trying to find ways to, you know,
that's beautiful.
Back that, myself into a
that
corner.
That is absolutely beautiful, Demi. I have heard another teacher who has explained to me that same type of mindset to do that, and that was Tom Rossman.
Oh yeah, yeah, Dr. Poole, right?
Dr. Poole. I asked Tom one time. He plays a little three cushion, and he was at a tournament and I said, "Listen, I'm having a little problem focusing." And I said, especially when I play a certain guy, it's one of those things, I just can't get by this one player, and everything I can do to lose, I do. I pull it off, make sure I lose to this fella. And he says, he said, well, just take and give him some money before you start,
and then plan for it.
No, and then just play them. Don't play them for money. Just give them some.
Well, Rob, you can do that with me anytime you want.
Yeah, you've got action, Rob. I'm liking this.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and he says, I'll tell you what, I guarantee you after that, you'll be beating them. You, this guy won't be a problem for you anymore.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really funny that we both and then Nate, you were starting to say something too. You were saying something about go ahead.
Yeah, so what I was gonna get at was my uncle started playing pool a little bit more, and he actually started playing after my mom passed, and my mom played obviously, and then he kind of decided that he would take the game up too. And so what I was doing to help him mark his progress, because everybody improves like crazy when you start out the game. If you're taking the game seriously and you're playing, you know, 3, 4, 5 times a week, you'll increase 100 Fargo points in a year really, really easily. It's not hard to go from a 400 to a 500 level player in 6 to 7 months. So what I had him do is I had him play the 8-ball ghost on a valley table. And I told him once every single week, I need you to play the ghost. I need you to play 2 to 3 warm-up sets. And then I need you to play one serious set. And I need you to write that down on a whiteboard next to your pool table. And I need you to clearly write it out as if it was as if it were a spreadsheet. And then you could basically do this for 52 weeks straight or however long it is. And you can see the progress that you're making, where you're losing 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 0. And then you're getting up to the point where you're getting into the twos, and it's 2 to 1, and then it's 2 to... Or it's 5 to 2, and it's 5 to 1, and it's 5 to 2, and you're bouncing back and forth between 1 and 2 instead of 0 and 1. And it's an actual increase that you can actually physically see, and you can mark where you've been and where you're at and where you're going. That is kind of what you're doing, Demetrius, by doing that, is if you were to take that and kind of, you know, continue that spread onward. But that is kind of the heart of what you're doing, is you're seeing what you're doing, and you're holding yourself accountable for the things that you're doing. And I think that's a really, really, really good way to not only motivate yourself to play serious and motivated, but also to continue to do that over a course of time to where you can see what happens when you actually do that.
Yes.
Yeah, anytime you write something down, you put it on paper and look at it.
It holds yourself accountable to that.
It does. It means something, whether you're doing it for things you want to learn how to do or get better at, or things you want to remember to do each time, or just the history. Give yourself a data to go off of. Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, it's I think a couple of weeks ago I said there's going to be almost nothing that we're going to be able to talk about. And, you know, are we going to continue to do the podcast? And I said, absolutely. We are all extremely good at bullshit. And I get to bleep that. It's going to be so satisfying. But we're all super good at coming up with absolutely nothing and making it sound almost listenable. So this is the segment where we talk. And actually, I should probably at this point in time, because we've actually with the recent Facebook interviews I've been doing, we've actually increased the listener base by a lot. Potentially, the Facebook reach has grown exponentially in the last basically week. I don't know how many of those people will make it over to the podcast, but if you do, just know that this is a segment where we talk about what happened in the previous week's matchups, tournaments, gambling, anything that's basically happened. We keep you up to date with everything that's going on in the pool world. In the last week, there really hasn't been much that went on, so we're kind of like
the Seinfeld of pool podcast. It's like the show about nothing, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, definitely over the last couple of weeks. But
we can talk about nothing for a long time.
Oh yeah. Ask my wife; she'll tell you.
But now you mentioned two challenge matches that we already kind of talked a little bit briefly about Tyler and Chris Robinson and Tyler Steyer. What was the other matchup that you're talking about that maybe I was asleep at the wheel?
Well, you're just going to have to wait another 2 to 3 minutes until we get to that segment.
Roy's basement?
Shut up, Rob. He's got to wait 2 to 3 minutes until we get to that segment.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I thought we were moving forward, but okay.
Oh, my God. I'm trying to explain to the dear listener the layout of the podcast, and you guys are trying to skip over segments. The next segment, we're going to talk about the things that are coming up in the next week. So let's just jump to that. We have nothing else to talk about right now. So to make Demetrius so happy, we'll talk about the upcoming matches. And we'll start with the one that he doesn't know about because why not? Warren Kiamko is going to be playing Joshua Filler, even up one pocket at Roy's Basement in a race to 24 over 3 days, race to 8 day one, race to 16 day two, and race to 24 to finish out for the cash. What do you think about that, Demetrius?
That's going to be fun to watch.
You can't pick like different, like contradicting styles. Like Joshua Filler is so loose and he just strokes so straight, but he just doesn't know the game. You know, he's been playing the game now for about 12 minutes, and Warren Kiamko has built a career off of this game. Warren Kiamko is super slow, super methodical, super smart. He just plays the game the way it's supposed to be played. So I got a feeling that this is a race to 8 day one. I honestly got a feeling like if Justin Bergman and let's say Corey Duell played a race to 8 in one pocket, it would probably take between 4 and 6 hours, probably 5 and 7 hours, actually, now that I think about it, probably a long time. I could see this going like 2 hours with the way Joshua Filler, like, he's either going to like make some shot that you didn't even know was possible and run out, or he's going to try that shot that you think's impossible, hang it, and then Warren Kiamko is going to run out. I just feel like this is going to be a super short day, but it's going to be like a really fascinating and exciting day.
Yeah, that's, you got to go with Warren matchup experience for sure.
Well, yeah, you know, that's a strange one because, I mean,
it's the Tony Chohan, Dennis Arcoyo from like 8 years ago. Dennis didn't really know the game. Tony was the old wise one pocket player, and Dennis could just shoot the lights out. And this is kind of the same format.
Yeah, I've got a boy. This is a tough one. So when it comes to this matchup, my general opinion on matching up one pocket is that people as a whole really, really tend to overrate moving in general. Okay. And so people like the idea of, I think everyone's got the secret fantasy that, you know, like maybe a lot of players that they're not necessarily top 9 ball players and they're, you know, they spend their life, but okay. Like, you know, I'm assuming most of the people here have watched The Hustler, you know, the character of Bird, right? You know, the the guy that's the poker player that, you know, knows all the moves and buys a new Cadillac every year because he's so smart. I think most people kind of think of themselves like, if they're not good enough to be Fast Eddie, then they like to think of themselves as Bert. And so they like the idea of being the guy that is in the know and that knows all the angles, and they know that they're a student of human moves, kid, and they know all the stuff. Most people think that they're really smart. And so then they identify with characters like that. And so when they think about One Pocket, they're like, oh, it's a moving game. It's a moving game. And players that are like, well, I'm just going to move the balls up table, then I'm going to outmove the guy because I'm a mover, because everyone thinks they're a genius. And that's fine. You know, it's just human nature. So, but I think as a result is that people tend to overrate moving because they like the idea of the old man that doesn't shoot all that straight, just outmoving the guy. Look at my experience and my cunning here. Whereas in reality, pool's pool. And when people can shoot balls in the hole, in general, I like to bet on the striker. I like to bet on the guy that can shoot better. And what I would say is, in general, people overrate moving. They underrate striking. And if there's a striking difference between two players, that's a substantial striking difference. For example, if Danny Smith was going to play Josh Filler, well, then I would say, people, you know, Danny Smith can move really, really well, but Josh Filler is such a beast with striking that to think that he's going to get outmoved, I would be hesitant to think that Josh is not going to win that match. But with all that being said, so I feel like I really had to make the case. I feel like moving is overrated, that in general, what I would say is it takes a very, very big difference in moving for it not to come down to who's the better striker. In this case, Warren Kiamko is not Tony Chohan. Warren Kiamko is a 792 Fargo, and he's not winning major tournaments, so you don't really see him in the finals a lot.
He's a Filipino, that's all you need to know.
He's been on the scene for 20 years, and he is a serious beast. And so the question is, does Josh Filler have enough of a striking edge to make up for the lack of experience? And it's a tough one. What do you guys think?
I think the obvious choice here is no. I think Warren, at least in my opinion, I think Warren Kiamko is not a huge favorite because of I do think that Joshua Filler right now is, I mean, he knows the table, he knows the playing atmosphere, and he's playing some really, really solid pool. I mean, I think it's Joshua Filler's, you know, everything screams Joshua Filler's going to be ready for this match, but I mean, you don't the number, like, you have the you gave us your number one rules for betting, and it's don't bet against Shane last week. And I, when it comes to One Pocket, I don't bet against Filipinos. I don't care who they are. I don't care if I can even pronounce their names. In One Pocket, I do not bet against Filipinos. So I got to hold true to that one there. Although if there's somebody who can outshoot a Filipino, it's, you found him.
How much? So I'm really feeling a little blind on, because I know Warren's nine ball game well. I've actually played him. I've only played him once. It was stunning, but I've played next to him and I've had a chance to see him at tournaments, and I have a ton of respect for the guy. He's like Yoda of pool. And so I'm sure he plays really, really good One Pocket. But the thing is, I haven't seen him like make huge runs at Derby lately. I haven't seen him win big One Pocket tournaments. I'm not saying he doesn't know the game and play it great, but it's a little different in the case of Tony Chohan and Dennis. It was a little different because Tony was a clear contender for being one of the best One Pocket players in the world. What has Warren done? Has Warren performed at One Pocket at a level recently that would put him in the top 5 or 10?
Didn't he win the Derby?
I think that was Boosty last year, right?
Boosty won the Banks Boosty won the Banks 2 years ago. Boosty won the One Pocket last year. I know that Warren Kiamko won very recently, like in the last three or four years, the U.S. Open One Pocket.
That's a pretty good resume boost.
Yeah.
Now, but meanwhile, Josh Filler, I'm sorry, you weren't done. Keep going.
Well, I was just going to say that, that doesn't get too much tougher of a field than any One Pocket tournament at Buffalo's, but I mean, Buffalo's gets, you know, in Louisiana, they get, you know, 16 of the top One Pocket players in the world. So, I mean, it's right on par with a tournament like that. So, I mean, a tournament win like that it's a big deal.
Yeah, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take a flyer. I'm going to go with Josh Filler here. Here's my thinking. I don't mind being wrong. I'll create a little controversy as far as we can't all agree on Warren. I definitely know that Warren can win it. Like, Warren can definitely win it. He shoots straight enough. He's experienced enough, and he's going to be managing the pace and the type of the game. And it's going to be a hard match for Josh to win. So I'm not saying I'm going to bet on Filler. I'm just saying I'll pick Filler. And so I could definitely see how Warren could win this and why he might even be a favorite on paper. The thing that I'll say though is that I feel like Warren might be more in a category of like look at Corey Duhl. Like, he's won tournaments and Scott Frost has won tournaments, but they're not quite at the same level as like the actual elite one pocket players. And so I just feel like maybe Warren fits more into like that Corey Duhl and that Scott Frost one pocket category. And I feel like Josh Filler, it's not like he's never played before. You know, he's played a few derbies. I'm sure he's played the game. I mean, he's matching up with people playing banks. I'm sure he plays everything, and I'm sure he's secretly working on his one pocket game and cramming up for this type of match. And honestly, it wouldn't surprise me if he's been putting in a lot of study and work on his one pocket game, waiting for somebody to try to take a shot at him, because he knows that nobody will play him nine ball right now. And so I just feel like you're right though. I mean, there is a certain amount of play you have to take, and you know, it's not nothing. I mean, he can't, and Warren plays so good that he's not playing Danny Smith. He's not playing me. He's playing a flat out Filipino champion. So it's like, yeah, he's not going to have as much of a shooting edge as he might need to outrun the experience. But on the other hand, I don't think he's going to be, and I do think that one pocket takes some growth. I mean, it does. There is a lot of knowledge. I'm not the same way a lot of people overrate how important the moving is. I mean, it's, you can underrate the moving. It is important, and the experience does matter. But I feel like he might be just a tad more experienced than people think, and that he's such a strong shooter, and he's a smart guy and knows how to win. I'll just say, I think it'll be a very fascinating matchup to watch, and I'm looking forward to seeing it. But I'll go ahead and pick Filler, just because in the end, I'll go down betting on the guy that doesn't ever miss.
Well, Rob, what do you think?
Yeah, you got to like the guy who can pocket the balls, that's for sure. And Filler is that guy. And here again, I think it's a coin toss.
But I can
call
see
the winner.
Yeah, and I can see. I mean, you mentioned Warren right away, Rob. And Nate, the funny part is, like, I can see it happening the other way, where Warren just puts a beat down so bad that he ends up out executing Josh, just based on Josh being completely befuddled and taking out a stroke, and Warren just kind of making him play his game. Like, it could definitely go that way. And if Warren can control the match to where he evens out the execution edge and just stays ahead of him as far as the type of game, I mean, it could be a heck of a hard day for Filler. So yeah. I definitely get that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm just leaning that way because of the experience, just the knowledge of the game. And it's hard to cram that knowledge. It's almost like you have to, in pool, you have to have the worst thing happen to you, it seems, before the knowledge comes.
There's a saying
that's what you remember.
You'll like this saying: experience is learning something you needed to know just after you needed to know it.
Right.
I do like that, because that's actually a fact. Yeah. Hindsight in pool is great, but you still have to execute. You can know everything you need to know. I mean, you can be the smartest mother in the classroom, and if you don't put it down when it needs to be put down on the pool table and executed, all that knowledge doesn't do you any good. So it's got to be a combination of both things going on at the same time. So I just give the edge to Kiamko in that.
I think you guys are right. I'm going to stick with Filler, just kind of like Fast Eddie on the billiard table.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a balance of stick. But I think that Kiamko plays so strong that even if they played like a 10 ball race to 30 or something, like, Kiamko's plays good enough that, I mean, maybe that would be a tough game, but if they played a race to 15, he could get there. You know what I mean? So it's like, yeah, there's just, he, that guy, I just have a ton of respect for Kiamko, but I'll take it this week. I'll take the underdog this week.
Yeah. So how I'm looking at this, and I'll try to make this quick. There are matches. Well, let's go back to the most recent one, Joshua Filler and James Aranis. You could picture James Aranis winning that maybe by a game or two. There's no way that you could I don't think that there's anybody who predicted James Aronis by more than 20 games. But it's very, I could easily see Joshua Filler winning that game, winning that set by way over 20 games. Going back to, like, the, let's say the last one, Sky Woodward and Alex Pagulayan. I could see Alex Pagulayan winning that narrowly. And actually, I predicted to him to win it narrowly. But I could also see Sky Woodward just running away with that set. But I could not see Alex Pagulayan running away with the set. Going back one more, Jason Shaw and Shane Van Boning. I could see Shane Van Boning running away with that. But I could see Jason Shaw winning that narrowly.
That's a very good point you're making. If the range is that one guy could eke it out, whereas the other guy could run away with it, then that means that the par is that the guy that could run away with it is probably a favorite.
What I was kind of getting at is I could see Joshua Filler winning this and winning this big, just purely by outshooting Kiamko. And I could see Kiamko winning this and winning this big just by outshooting or outmoving and just outknowing the game over Joshua Filler. This is like a set where I honestly could see both players winning this set by 8 games. You know, like a 24-16 kind of score. And that makes it really hard to choose, but I mean, I'm choosing Kiamko. I think Kiamko is going to win this set, but I think this one, normally when we say it's going to be close, it's like, well, yeah, this person will probably get to 90 out of 100, and that's probably pretty close. I mean, that's winning a set on the hill to 10, right? So that's a pretty close set, even if it's not 99-99 at the end. I could see this going 24-20, something like that, within a couple game stretch. And I think I probably will, but I think I got to go with Kiamko over the stretch. So that's just like my bigger idea of how I kind of look at these bettings when I'm making my bets.
One of the things I'll say is that I am dealing with, like, I think that matching up one pocket can be very, very challenging. And when you're matching up two players I haven't seen play a lot of one pocket and then try to predict how their different styles and how their different strengths are going to intersect over a game like one pocket, boy, I have been like the most wrong I've ever been has been betting on players I don't know very well playing one pocket. I have been absolutely embarrassed trying to make an outcome.
I guess we kind of beat that dead horse. The official picks of the podcast is Rob and I are taking Kiamko and Demetrius is taking Filler, I think, unless I'm wrong on that for anyone.
Well, let's go with it.
All right.
And the final score will be?
I'll say 24-21.
24-21 Kiamko?
24-21 Kiamko.
I'll go 24-19 Filler.
I'm going to go 24-22 Kiamko.
Well, I think all of those would be pretty fun to watch. I mean,
they would be.
Yeah. So we can leave that there and we can move on to the next match, which is actually chronologically happening first, and that is going to be Chris Robinson and Tyler Steyer. And I will start this off with my analysis because I want to echo kind of what Joshua Filler said on air while his wife Pia was playing the ghost for Roy's Basement's stream. And what Joshua Filler said when asked was, basically, he was asked who he thinks is going to win. And his response was, well, I think Chris Robinson is actually hitting the ball straighter than Tyler is right now. But Tyler has a break that is very, very good and admirable. And Chris doesn't have the break that Tyler has. This is essentially what he said. And for that reason, he doesn't see a way that Chris Robinson can win in a race to 100 because he can't fade the break. Almost all of these discussions when we're talking about a race to 100, that is pretty much my exact analysis, is whoever breaks the balls better, it's really, really tough to fade that over the course of a race to 100 because the difference in shooting styles is shooting abilities is like, it's on the margins for a lot of these players. They're so good. They're not going to miss an easy shot. Generally speaking, they're going to miss positioning. Well, what's the easiest way to not have to worry about tough transitions, controlling everything on the break. And whoever's the best at that usually is the person that ends up winning these sets. So I will just basically leave my analysis there with what Joshua Filler said, because I agree with it 100%. I think Tyler wins this set only because his break is world quality 10 ball break.
Yeah, I go with Tyler too. And for pretty much all the same reasons. I haven't watched Chris play. and Tyler I have watched quite a bit. And he's just solid, you know, and I see Chris's name now. He came in, what did he come in that last tournament he played?
5th, 6th.
Yeah,
Chris is hitting him really good. He might be hitting him straighter than Tyler right now. I'm not arguing with that at all. I think he actually may be, but I know that he doesn't break the balls as good as Tyler, but he might shoot better, but I know he doesn't break better.
Yeah, it was funny. Tyler, when he was breaking against the match he lost, 7-1, the last tournament he played in. His opening match, I believe, or not the second match. And it was the breaks that doomed him. You know, two scratches on a break and one.
You're talking Tyler against Nayuki Oi?
Yeah. And that was only a race to 7. I mean, that's not a race to 100. It's, you know, just a race to 7. So, and he had 3 consecutive breaks in a row where bad stuff happened to him.
Yeah, he had a free kick into the side pocket twice, and then he broke dry once, if I remember right.
Yeah.
Well, Demetrius, what do you think?
Yeah, I kind of mentioned it last week. I picked Tyler, you know, really. And it's funny because when you're talking about guys like Tyler and Chris and you're talking about how they play, you have to be extra careful because they're getting better so much so fast that if you're like, oh, I saw Chris play a year or two ago, it's like, well, that's like.
Did you really?
Yeah. So it's like, I've seen Chris play, but I haven't seen, you know, I've seen Chris play 6 months ago. I've seen Chris play a year ago. I saw him play a little bit at Derby and he was hitting him good, but like he could be up a ball in the last 3 months. You know what I mean? So that's the funny part about young guys, you know? So, I mean, they're both great players, but I think the number one, I did mention the break. I 100% agree. Tyler's got one of the best breaks I've ever seen. Add to that, he shoots jump shots and elevated shots extremely well.
He's really good at those.
And I really feel that jump shots and elevated shots, they're not the most important shot. Like, first you have to learn to run the balls out. But then once you get to the point where everybody runs out, the guy that can break well, that's the biggest thing. The guy that can jump well and shoot elevated shots well, that's a big factor. And then the last part was the fact that he just won the Kremlin Cup last year. And so he's proven that he's got, you know, the heart and the confidence to play, you know, anybody and know how to win. And I think the only other thing I was going to say is I really give Tyler credit. I think Chris does a really good job of a lot of this stuff too, but like Tyler, I think Tyler won me as a fan when I found out that when he was preparing for the 2018 Moscone Cup by practicing pool with headphones, listening to a recording of people chanting Europe. And like, did you guys hear this? Remember what I was talking about? He knew he was going to be playing in the Moscone Cup. And so he recorded a bunch of like Europe chants and a bunch of the people heckling him, you know, the Moscone Cup heckling crowds. Mm-hmm. And then he listened to that while he practiced to kind of prepare himself for that. Mm-hmm. And it's like he's running every morning. He's at the gym and he's got a really, really good diet. Like this kid is, when I see somebody putting that kind of work on their diet, on their fitness, on their practice, and then you look at all the and look at the results he's had in the last year or two, being on the Moscone Cup, winning a major tournament, and then you look at his skills, difficult, awkward shots, and his safety play, being coached by Johan, and then you top it all off with a King Kong break. You know, again, Chris could get the job done, absolutely, but I gotta like Tyler.
Yeah, I know that. How authentic is something like this coming out of my mouth? Because I say this about every single match that I watch that I'm really excited to watch it. But I would consider both of these players friends, personal friends. So I feel like I have a little bit extra just being able to watch this match because I do have a personal connection with both of the players. And I'm just really excited to watch some high quality pool that's not a rerun to where I don't, you know, I love the Matchroom is doing all of their, reviews on their previous tournaments, and I just love watching it, but I'm watching it knowing exactly what's going to happen. And I actually talked about this with Emily for a little while. I'm watching the 2018 Moscone Cup, and I can even every now and then they'll even pan the crowd, and I can pick myself out in the crowd, And you know, I know what's going to happen. I know the exact shots. I know which shots are going to be missed. My heart gets racing, even though I know what's going to happen, and I still love it. I still love it as a fan, knowing what's going to happen. But my point is, I'm really happy to get some new content and some new high-quality content. So I'm excited for this match to happen, and I will pick it. Tyler Steyer wins 100-84, which seems to be always my right around my number, but that's usually because, I don't know, it's usually a popular number to hang around. So I'll go 184, Tyler. But, I mean, I think Chris Robinson is one of the brightest points in American pool that we have going for us from a youth perspective. I love his fire. I love his passion. And a lot of the things that you said about Tyler earlier, Demetrius, those same exact things are found in Chris Robinson. He's got the heart of a lion in him. So I hope it's really close. I hope it's a great match for everybody to get to watch. And yeah, so that's my prediction.
One fun part about watching is that they both play good enough that they can play as good as anyone in the world, but they're also still at a level where it's not boring to watch because they still have to, like when you watch Shane play filler, like that, well, first of all, that won't happen. But if you did, you know, we've all kind of had that mixed emotion where it's like, it can almost be boring because once they make a ball in the break, it's hard to stay interested because the suspense is gone. You just know they're running out.
Yeah.
And with Tyler and Chris, they can play like that where they have stretches where they can just run out for, you know, 10, 20, 30 games. They can play airtight, but then they can also have stretches where when the other guy's playing well and when they're been iced for a while or they're getting difficult opportunities, they're not the same level of machine as a filler or a Shane. And so there is a little bit more suspense when you're watching the racks to find out, you know, if the momentum's going to shift or when, you know, when a mistake might creep in. And so I actually think it's a really, really fun match to watch. And I'm not saying it's the full range where you've got a really, really, really high level of pool, but still a little bit of suspense.
Did you want to get, since you just gave that, do you want to give your score for it too?
You know, I feel like I must be overestimating Tyler or underestimating Chris. So I was going to suggest that, you know, I might even take the Tyler holding him to under 80. But it sounds like there's a few things I don't know. I might have a poker hand that's second best here.
Tough to call the numbers on this one, really.
Yeah, Rob.
And now I'm afraid because what's going to happen is Chris is going to listen to this, and next time I play him in a tournament, he's gonna blank me, man. He's gonna beat me 9-0, and he's gonna be like, he's just gonna beat me 9-0. He's just gonna look at me, and he's gonna play this clip, and he's gonna play this clip and stare at me, and I'll be like, all right, you got me.
Yeah, that's what's gonna happen. Yeah, he's gonna bleed you dry.
That's all right. He earns it. He earns it.
It's funny because actually this would be something that would motivate Chris, I believe. From the personality, from the gauge I have of his personality, this does seem like something that would motivate him if he listened to it.
Well, it should, man. And you know what? I'm not betting against him. I'll tell you that. And what happens in this match, you know, one thing, I'll put it this way. I'm betting on both these guys in the years ahead. I'm glad, you know, people, it's gotten to be such a long time where it's like, oh, U.S. doesn't have any good young players. Well, now, I really think that with Tyler, with Chris, and, you know, again, with that, I mentioned that Jesus Atencia that I played down at the Derby. I think we've got, you know, not to mention, I mean, I'm already taking it for granted that we have Sky and Billy, but we really have, you know, a pretty good crew compared. I know it's always easy to make, you know, the Filipinos or the Europeans or the Chinese and the Masters. But really, we have some super, super good players. And you know what? You can't sit there and say, oh, our players just play cash games and they don't go play the tournament and they don't travel. It's like, no. You know, Tyler's traveling. Chris is traveling. These guys are getting in the ring. These guys are getting in the ring and playing matchups. These guys are getting in the ring playing tournaments. Like, they're attending to their fitness and all the mental preparation and, you know, the diet and just all. I mean, you can't attack how much these guys are bringing to the game and how much they're going all in, nor can you argue with the results that they've been getting. So I really feel like not only am I not betting against Chris, it's Chris and Tyler that are putting U.S. pool players, U.S. youth pool players back on the map. I'm proud of them both.
For sure. I agree. So Rob, what's your prediction then?
My prediction is, Tyler, and you want me to put a number on this?
I want you to put a number on this.
See, that's what's going to be tough, to put a number on without whatever.
Well,
without
this is why I pay you the big bucks,
Chris
Rob.
Play. It's going to be tough.
This is why I pay you the big bucks.
Okay. 100 to 89.
All right. That's a good prediction. So I guess we can leave that discussion there, and we can move on to the discussion topic and the end of the podcast. So, Rob, you had
yes.
a discussion topic that you wanted to chat about.
Well, I have a question, actually, and it was a kind of an insight on the Fargo numbers. And I dwell on this a little bit because I have friends that ask me about these numbers all the time, and I'm not a math guy. And I try to put them into perspective. Okay, they go anywhere from, what, 350 to 850, okay? And when I look at the separation of in 50-degree increments, like 4 to 450 to 5, 550 to 6, 650 to 7, 750, like that, I see as the numbers go up that there's numerically the 50-point differences are all the same. They're 50. But as the numbers get higher, I feel that they're compressed, or they should be compressed. In other words, the value between a 450 and a 500 is really wider than 50. And the value between 7 and 750 is smaller. It's not 50 points. It's maybe 15 or 20, although the figures say 50. To me, it just can't be. That 700 doesn't play like a 500 or a 550, the difference between those two numbers. They're closer than that. And how do you justify then having a rating system that is just one number apart? It's 6, 601, 602, 603, or 5, 501, 502, 503. I think those numbers, as you get higher, the values are compressed. They're closer together.
I actually disagree with that completely. I think Demetrius is going to be the best person to answer this one, but I actually find it completely opposite, because I think the Fargo rating, how I look at the Fargo rating, is it's more or less a predictor of how many mistakes you're going to make. And I think that, let's take...
That's a good example. You use that one, and then I'll interject what I'm thinking with it.
Well, I think the difference between a Joshua Filler, and who's an 870 would be somebody like a... Or a 770 would... But I think the difference between those two players is significantly more than a player that's, let's say, 610 to me at 660. I think that the difference between there is when you're Joshua Filler at an 823, or I think he's an 823, the difference between him and basically somebody 50 points less is somebody 50 points less makes mistakes. Joshua Filler, as a Fargo being used as a predictor of how many mistakes you're going to make, Joshua Filler doesn't make mistakes. Shane Van Boning, when he's on and he's actually playing at his number, doesn't make mistakes. Jason Shaw doesn't really make mistakes at that number. Where 770s, they'll still make plenty of mistakes from time to time. And when you're talking like that, I mean, so a 770, if they play, let's say they play a race at 21, the 820 is supposed to win probably 21 to 16, 21 to 15, something like that. According to the Fargo rates, I think it's easier for that to get out of control than it would be for me to be playing a 610 the same race, because I'm going to make more mistakes. So you're basically just capitalizing on, I think that I'm going to be making more mistakes where the 610 will give them back, and I might even give them back again. At 820, there's just no mistakes to give up.
I don't think it's quantity of mistakes. I think it's the very few difference between them is that the advantage that's taken from the player that's 50 points higher, neither one makes many mistakes, but the one that's 50 points higher is probably going to take more of an offensive advantage over the course of 100 games for sure because of that higher number. But I, if you're talking mistakes, if you're talking about the quality of play, if you go a 550 and a 600, that's way more difference in ability and mistakes than a 750 and 800.
So let me jump in here. So I've got a few, and what you're saying makes sense. So I think that what you're both saying, there's some parts of it that make sense. So one thing I'll say, Rob, is that if you look at a traditional handicap, let's say the 7-8, I'm going to spot somebody the wild 7-8, or why do I have to be so hard on myself? Maybe somebody's going to spot me the 7-8. So in any case, if you take a fixed handicap like this wild 7-8 in a game of nine ball, the higher the skill level is, the less that spot makes a difference because the more both players can run the table anyway. So
yes,
it hardly matters. So what you're feeling is that both players are so good and they're both capable of running out a set perfectly. Therefore it's, you know, and we've all seen it where, like, you know, beginner players where one guy can run four balls and the other guy can only run three balls. The guy that can run four balls has a huge advantage. Whereas at the high level, they could both run so many racks.
That's what I'm saying.
So I feel you. Like, I'm validating what you're saying. That's a feeling that's based on traditional handicapping, which is like 7-8 or that kind of difference, which is the difference in skill between lower level players is more pivotal of a match than the difference in skill between higher level players. That's right. All true. On the other hand, I think that one thing that's true about high level players is in terms of improvement, if you're trying to get better, getting from a 450 to a 500 is far easier
than
getting from 750 to an 800 or something like that. And so on the other end, it's even though in terms of like your improvement curve, half of the work of your entire pool career might be going from 750 to 8.25 compared to the other half being starting out to get into 750. So it's every Fargo point at the end is harder to gain. And so it might be compressed in the sense of improving is much, much, much harder. And there's a difference in terms of the abilities of players very pronounced because it's so hard to climb. So you're both right on some areas. But here's the funny part about Fargo rate. Nate, you mentioned it was a predictor. You know, it's a predictor. Actually, I don't know that you were dying on the hill. You just mentioned the word. But it's a common misconception. Fargo rate is not actually – I mean, it's okay. You can use it as a predictor. You can put in numbers and predict things. But what it's really – people don't understand is that it's really just a score. So it's almost like, you know, a lot of times people like will look at Fargo and they'll be like, well, that guy is underrated or this guy really doesn't play as good as that guy. How come that's, you know, how come he could be a 750 and that guy's a 750? This guy's no way he's as good. It's like, that's it. That, and I write this on AZ Billiards. People were always throwing stones at Fargo when it first came out. And I'm like, it's almost Fargo rate is just a compiled score. That's all it is. It's of all the matches. So it's almost like if somebody played a tournament, a race to 11, and player A beat player B 11-8, that would be like everybody saying, well, player A, I mean, he's not the better player. There's no way he's the better player. Player B's the better player. He can't, you know, it's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. All I'm doing is saying player A won 11-8. That's all I'm saying. And so we can use that to make predictions, and the more data we have, the better those predictions are. But in the end, Fargo rates are nothing more than a compilation of all the different outcomes that we've had. And so they're not, it can be used for predictions, but it's really just a historic record of what has happened. So then here's the funny part is in terms of the predicting part, if you, and I just did this, if you go to their Fargo rate website, you can put in what happens if a 500 plays a 550 in a race to nine. Who's, you know, what's the likelihood based on our, you know, based on the historic data and the calculated win rates. And it turns out that the better player, the 550, is 76.5% to win that match. So then you go ahead and you put in 750 against an 800. And the 800 is 76.5% to win. So the point is that Fargo is linear because it is not something like it puts in the points and then it's making these predictions, and it's like the points are by definition spaced so that every 100 Fargo rate points, in other words, it's not just saying every 100 Fargo rate points translates into a 2-to-1 outcome. So if a 600 plays a 700, 100 games, the 700 is going to win 66.6 on average, you know, 700s against average 600s on an average day. Well, so, and what they're not doing is just shooting from the hip and then saying, I think this guy plays 700. I think that guy plays 600. And, oh, really? You think he's going to win 2 out of 3? I don't think so. It's like, it's actually the reverse of that. It's how many games have these guys played against each other? Well, they've played 1,000 games. This guy's won 666. Okay, well, then I predict that he's going to win 2 out of 3. It's not making predictions by shooting from the hip. It's looking at what has happened and then using historical data to just copy back. Well, here's, if we extend what's happened in the past into the future, here's what is likely to happen. That's all it's doing. If it's basically saying, here's what's already happened, so therefore, if it happens again like it's already happened, this is what would happen. That's all Fargo Rate's doing. If it happens again like it's already happened, then here's what the outcome is. And then it's, and then the scores are plugged in so that those percentages equate to, you know, so that the numbers that they have equate to the percentages that they've historically had. So it's absolutely foolproof. It's absolutely, it's with a big sample size. It's really, really, really good. Now you've got people that are improving very, very quickly, that, or people that don't have a lot of historic games on the record. And then there's times when, yeah, it could be, it can underrate somebody a little bit, or it might not know that somebody plays really, really good one pocket, or that somebody's not a very good cash player. They play mostly tournaments. So there's a couple times when you might not want to bet your bankroll on it. However, it's the only criticism anybody can have of Fargo Rate is comparing it to absolute perfect. Like, in other words, somebody that can see the future and actually knows what's going to happen betting. If you compare it to that, then it's not very good. But if you compare it to any other system that's ever been made, it is in a class of its own. So anyway, long rant. I'm a big believer in Fargo. But yes, a 50-point gap, it's not condensed at the top. It's not condensed at the bottom. It's exactly the same. And it's backfilled based on what's actually happened. So that's it.
Yep. I'm a huge believer in Fargo Rate as well. Rob is skeptical on some things, but I think as a whole, I think you think it's a good system, right, Rob?
I'm skeptical.
Okay. All right.
That's what I'll say.
Well,
I'm not a fan of Fargo because the transposition of scoring the game into a number for you, I have a hard time with it. I have a hard time thinking it can even be done, because the game is complicated. The game, although it looks easy, one ball in a hole, two, three, four, they just go in the holes and that's it. Boom, boom, boom. But the things that can happen in a game, and we can really use the filler Aranis matchup for this. You know, Aranis makes, what's his number? He was like 20, 30 less or whatever.
Yeah, I think right now he's at 806. So you
can predict that filler's going to win the match based on a number. That's a prediction for the future. You can say he's going to win. Okay. But what happened in the match? The numbers don't tell you what happened. The numbers don't tell you, you know, Aranis made like 3 mistakes, missed 3 balls the whole match.
Well, I mean, but it
and that was a difference in the match. And besides the breaking, we know it was a difference. But
that Fargo Rate can predict stuff like that. And that's actually that's kind of what I was getting at when I use it to kind of predict the amount of mistakes that are going to be made. You're going to expect Aranis to make a few more mistakes than Joshua Filler. And you're going to expect him to be in kind of situations where you can't necessarily control your mistakes, because those are the hardest thing. Breaking the balls is the hardest thing to control everything on the table. And Joshua Filler is so much better at doing that. And that's, you know, a lot of the mistakes that that James Aranis made were on the break shot. You know,
maybe you should have a Fargo number for break shots.
Well, you know, here's
separate number.
This is actually a couple points here. You know, there is a fact that there's a smaller perceivable difference in skill between a 750 and an 800 versus a 500 and a 550. But here's what people don't realize is that, so the difference between a five, if we want to measure missed shots, so like if we're measuring missed shots, Rob, you're right. There's probably a bigger difference in number of shots missed between a 500 and a 550 versus a 770 and an 820. But what you're not, you know, but we're not measuring strictly missed shots. We're also measuring outcomes of games. So what you got to realize is that maybe the difference between a 500 and a 550 is 10 missed shots over a 3 hour session or a 6 hour session. Whereas at that level with a Ronison filler, or I should say somebody with a 50 point gap, maybe the difference is only, you know, 4 missed shots instead of a 10 missed shot difference over a session. But what we don't realize is that the 10 missed shots might only help the 550 win 3 extra games, whereas those 4 missed shots might be really, really big at the higher levels.
Oh, yeah.
They punish those mistakes. So when you actually look at the difference in win rates, that's where it ends up being the same difference in win rate. And then to the point about the break shot being baked in, that's actually something I wanted to, that's something I talked about with Shane and with Filler, and how I was talking about, I personally think that Filler has been burning with confidence and with hunger and desire, and that Shane has been, you know, a little lackluster in terms of engagement. And so when it came to a matchup between them, I think I made the point that some people would look at that and say, well, I'd rather bet on the hungrier guy. But what I would say is Shane's an 826 performance while he's lackluster and disengaged, and Filler's a 724 when he's fired up and hungry and confident. And if Filler's reign of absolute invincibility is not over, but it's at least not quite as bright, and Shane, if he were to play a match with Filler, would get really hungry, I actually feel like that you have to understand, you can't sit there and say, well, this guy's an 826 and oh, he breaks really, really good. It's like, no, that break is already built into that. And so I feel like if Shane were to play a match with Filler, his engagement would kick up, he'd end up playing stronger on average, and whereas I don't think Filler can play any stronger than he's already playing. And so that's the kind of thing. So it's like, when you're going to bet on a guy, you can't say, well, they're both 800s. I'd rather bet on the guy with a better break, because it's an 800 with the better break. And so you just have to realize everything's already baked in. So then you got to ask yourself, what changes to their turf are they going to be playing on that might not have already been baked in? You got to think about those things, but that's where you got to draw that line.
Yep. I think that's a pretty good discussion on some aspects of Fargo rate that maybe you don't normally
and there's
have.
Always a few, you know, there's always a few flat earthers, man. I mean, Max Eberle, shout out. There's my second shout out to Max Eberle. I mean, Rob, I get it, man. I get it. We don't want to sail too far. We don't want to run into the dome, the glass dome or whatever. Is that, I don't know what's at the edge.
Yeah, no, I agree. But, so we can leave that there, and we can move on to our two tip segment. And I will start this off, and I will be very, very close. I will be very, very quick with mine. It's an easy one. If you are stuck in this lockdown and you just want to play pool and you can't, just honestly get some balls, throw them down on the carpet, and hit them around for a little while. I threw a glass down, or I threw a cup down the other day on my floor and hit some balls around into it, and it's kind of fun. So it's a different atmosphere. You got to actually hit some balls pretty hard, because of course you're hitting through carpet, which is, you know, a lot. It's going to slow your balls down a lot faster than normal felt would. So, but it's kind of fun to actually juice balls up and hit balls 20, 25 feet, because you know, if you have 25 feet worth of carpet in your apartment, it's kind of fun to do. So I did that a couple times, and at 25 feet, you really find out if you can stroke a ball well. So that'll be my advice, is just maybe throw some balls down and hit them around if you don't have access to a pool table.
Yeah, and use golf balls if you don't want to use pool balls. I actually play with golf balls on a 9-foot pool table, hitting regulation size balls in the hole with a golf ball, shooting them in. The problem is, and you can do it fairly accurately, and pocket balls, they go real slow, even if you shoot the golf ball hard. But the problem is, when you shoot the golf ball hard, the golf ball goes all over the table, you know, back and forth all around like crazy. But anyways, that's not my tip. My tip is this, and it's for 8-ball. And I see this happening all the time. I see guys out there banging the balls around, and they get in a position where they can shoot 4 different balls in the hole. And they're thinking about it. Now, which one's the best one to shoot? Which one should I shoot? This one, that one, or that one? And when I look at that situation on the table, the first thing I ask myself is, the cue ball is in a specific spot. Is there any way now I can get back to this same spot where I'm at to shoot this particular ball, which is kind of maybe from where you are an obvious ball to pocket? Guys many times will shoot a different ball. They won't shoot that ball. They'll just pick one of the other four balls they can shoot and make, considering all those four shots are all about the same skill level to pocket the ball. And I would ask these players to think about one thing. How hard is it for me to get this cue ball back to exactly the spot it's in right now to pocket this particular ball in that particular pocket? Because if you say to yourself, well, I don't know how I'm going to get back here, then that's the ball you should shoot out of those four balls you can pick from. It's because you ask yourself that question and answer it, and then that narrows those choices down. That's my tip. If you're going to have trouble getting back to where you already are, shoot the ball that's the most obvious from where you are.
Yep.
Is that clear enough?
Yeah, makes sense. Okay. I guess from there we can move on to our coach's corner. Demetrius, do you want to take it away?
Outstanding.
Welcome to another edition of the Coach's Corner. Demetrius Gelatis here with MN Pool Bootcamp. You can check out my website at www.mn, like for Minnesota, mnpoolbootcamp.com. Run these 3-day boot camps for people all over the country where you can come work on your game and leave not only a different level player, but never see the pool table the same way again. All right, moving on. This is the second part of my commander versus soldier conversation about process versus result goals. And so if you didn't catch the first half, check out last week, because I was going into the first half, talked a bit about process goals versus result goals, how process goals are your short-term and outcome goals are your long-term goals, and a little bit about that. So this week, I want to talk about the relationship between the two, and this is really, really important. This is all great in theory, but like, what are the problems that this helps solve? You know, people, let me just talk about why this is important before I go into it. People always ask me questions about like, well, what do you do when you play a better player? And how do you keep, you know, how do you keep from getting nervous, or how do you do this or that? And how do you handle, you know, and it's like, you know, there's like, oh, well, you just play the table, It's like, no. So this, there's a lot of problems that people have that can be fixed by having the right outlook on what we're doing here. And a lot of that comes down to how the process and the long-term outcomes go together. So catch the first episode if you haven't, or if you have, I'd recommend you listen to it so you're fresh. But moving on, the key is the relationship. So the commander is the long-term guy. He's looking at the big picture. His job, he's there to win the war. And so there's going to be a lot of battles in the war, but he's there to win the war, and the war is the long-term outcomes. Those are your long-term goals that you want to control. So that's what the commander's job is. How am I going to win this war? And in that war, he's going to have a lot of battles. And in those battles, he's going to have the soldier fight a lot of fights. And that's the short term. So the commander and the soldier each have a role. The commander's job is the commander's job is to make sure that he has a, and here's the word, foolproof. It's got to be a foolproof plan to win the war. That is the commander's job. How can I make sure that at the end of this war, we win the war? Like, we're going to lose battles, we're going to lose soldiers, but at the end, man, we will win this war. It has to be a foolproof plan, and you'll see why in a second. So that's his job. And then the soldier's job is to go into battle and fight and be willing to die for his, you know, his troops, his country, his leader. And he has to just go fight to the death. And then if the commander has a foolproof plan, and if the soldier trusts his commander and goes in and fights to the death in every battle, there will be battles lost, but the war will be won. So what are the mistakes that people make? And how does this perspective change, you know, solve some of these problems that people tell me they have? Well, a big mistake that people make is that they don't have a realistic foolproof goal. So maybe their goal is I would say that it's people a lot of times they come up with an unrealistic goal, and or they don't budget for mistakes and losses. And so that's just not good, because what happens is, if the commander says, okay, here's my plan, and I've heard this, man, I've heard this, it's silly what people come up with for goals, but it's like, if the commander says, here's what we're going to do, we're going to go play a bunch of pool tournaments, and you're never going to miss a ball, and you're never going to lose a match, and you're going to win every match, make every ball, and beat everybody, and always win. That's how we're going to win the war. Well, that doesn't make any sense. It's like the Wookiee defense. You could Google it, look it up on YouTube. The Wookiee defense. It's Chewbacca. This is Chewbacca. It does not make sense. Okay, so how's that? So what happens when you have an unrealistic goal and you haven't budgeted for loss? What does that do to the soldier? The soldier is supposed to, he's fighting his battle. He's playing the games. You turn into the soldier as soon as you screw your queue together. You're supposed to be focused on fighting to the death and focusing on your processes, right? Well, okay, so you screw your queue together. I'm like, I'm process-minded. And then all of a sudden you realize, oh, but wait. If I play my best, that's not good enough. The only way I can hit my long-term goals, apparently, is to never miss a ball and never lose a game. Ah, that's pressure, man. I don't know if I can do that. And so that leads to a tremendous pressure, fear of exposure, doubt, and then despair, hopelessness, frustration. And, you know, it's a lack of trust in your commander. Like, why did my commander send me out here to die? I can't do this. And this is all for nothing. And this pain and suffering I'm going through is pointless because I'm never going to get anywhere. And I can't do everything. How can I possibly do this? And this is, you know, all those different negative emotions. All the negative emotions for us. And then in the end, he hates his commander. He's like, that commander's stupid. And then it leads to feeling like I've got to do more than my best. My best isn't good enough. And that's a horrible thing. All these things, it's horrible to be thinking my best isn't good enough. I'm never going to hit my goals. If I miss this ball, it's all over for me. And, you know, it's just, how are you going to play well? I don't understand. How are you going to focus on your process goals? Doesn't make any sense. So instead, suppose the commander budgets for loss and has a foolproof plan where it's like, we're going to go to these tournaments, you're going to practice, you're going to journal about what mistakes you made, you're going to practice those mistakes at home, you're going to watch videos and then practice them and play with your buddies and try to spar and work on those things, and then you're going to go run it again in the next tournament, and you're still going to accept that it might take a little bit longer than you wish it would take, and that we don't know exactly how long it's going to take, so we're going to be very, very conservative on our expectations here. But we're going to keep doing this because I believe this is a winning plan. And if I stick to this plan, I will get here at some point. And that's exciting to me. And it's realistic enough. You know, I don't want to get into goal setting, but I mean, a goal has to be believable, but exciting. It's got to be exciting enough to motivate you, but realistic enough to be believable. Otherwise, if you don't believe it, then it's not going to be exciting. It's, in order for it to be exciting, it's got to be believable, but it's got to be big enough to be exciting and realistic enough to be believable. So if you set up a goal like that and you lay out a foolproof plan, then the soldier can look at that and say, well, that's great. I could just go play pool. And I don't have to worry about making every ball and winning every match because I have trust in my commander. And so as long as I play my hardest and as long as I try to win this war, even if I fall in battle today, we're going to win the war. And that is comforting. That's a comforting thought. And so whenever you have a thought that says, well, you might miss this ball, as a soldier, you can just say, yep, I might. Well, you might lose this match. Yep, that could happen. Okay, but that's not really what I'm worried about here. What I'm worried about is I'm going to take a deep breath, make a good decision, and now I'm going to try to swing my cue through straight, or whatever it is that your process is. And so that's, to me, that's where you want to play from. So that the soldier has to trust his commander. The soldier's job is to focus on process and trust his commander. But the commander's job is to make it a foolproof plan that warrants the soldier's trust. And that's it. It's the relationship has to be very trusting between them. And it hinges on a realistic plan that the soldier can believe in enough to die in. So a couple examples of how that comes up. So say people are like, oh, how do you play against a better player? Okay, well, with a losing plan, without a good realistic goal, then you might just go into that and be like, oh, I need to beat this guy. How am I ever going to do that? Well, if I beat him, then I prove that I'm the kind of guy that can beat this player. And if I don't, then I guess I'm still just that lousy loser. And it's like when your entire belief in your plan and your entire belief in yourself as a player hinges on the outcome of something you can't control, that's not good. But with this mindset, you can say, you know what? I know that I have a winning plan. I'm going to practice my thing. I'm going to get in the ring. I'm going to play players like this more and more often in tournaments. I'm probably going to lose a lot of matches at different times. But eventually, I will become a player that can win matches off these guys. At first, never. Then sometimes. Then often. And so, I'm on the road to getting there. And this is a step there. And I'm excited and proud of myself for taking a step in that direction. And so, I don't have to beat this player today. So, how do I play better players? I don't have to beat that player. All I have to do is die trying. That's all I have to do is die trying. And it's inevitable because my plan is foolproof. So I can't guarantee anything in the short term, but that's why I don't try to. I just try to focus on my process. But I'm confident. So I can get up there and I can lose and I can miscue and I can choke and I can lose to these players. And that's fine because I've budgeted for that. And I know that's going to happen. And I'm just excited to be on a road where it's inevitable that some good things are going to happen for me too at sometimes. And so that's awesome. So when I play a better player, I just look at it like, I'm probably going to lose. I'm probably going to die in battle today. But every time I make a ball and every time I win a game against this better player, like nothing bad can happen. I can get beat 11-0. I cannot make a ball. That's fine. But every ball I make and every game I win is one step closer to my goal. It's one less enemy survivor that can go on and go raid my city and attack my family and my countrymen. So I'm here to die. I'm willing to give my life in battle today to take out as many of these suckers as I can. Like, that's kind of my mindset. And I'm prepared to die in battle because I trust my commander. So that's how I look at playing better players. And then as far as the only other thing is, I have seen people, and it's rare, but I have seen people take the process goals too far, where they're so process-minded that they're afraid to be competitive, or they're afraid to, like, you know, they almost get to the point where they're like just kind of stroking into a Coke bottle waiting for their game to come together, kind of a thing where it's like, I'll just do my processes and then I'll let it come together. But here's the thing. You have to want to win today. And so this is where it's kind of sounds like a contradiction. How do you want to win today but then not care if you win? It's like, no, you don't. I thought of this. It's what happened is I played a match where I thought about that. I really wanted to win this match. If I won this match, it would have been something I've never done before in pool. And I remember really, really wanting it. But then I asked myself, which is more important? Like, I want to be the player that can win a match like this someday. And I realized today might not be my day. Maybe today is not the day I can win a match like this. But that's okay. As long as I know that someday I will win this match. So as long as I know someday I'll win this match, I'm okay not winning it today. However, the only way that I'll know that someday I will win this match is if I try really, really hard to make it today. Because if I don't try my hardest, and I'm not going to grow, and then I'll never be the player that wins a match like this. So I have to want it so bad that I try my hardest to make it today, but then be okay with the fact that it might not be. And so this is, I don't know if that makes sense. You might have to listen to it twice. It's hard to talk about these ideas, especially one way into a podcast and a non-conversation. But what I would say is that I stumbled across a Vince Lombardi quote, you know, the famous coach, and he actually said, winning isn't everything. The will to win is everything. And I thought about that. I'm like, yes, that's exactly what I've been trying to say. It's not important whether or not I win today, because it is important that I am trying my hardest to win today, because as long as I'm dying trying to win today, then I know I'll win at some point. And so that I don't have to win today. So it's a little circular. As long as I'm willing to die trying to win today, it'll happen eventually. And if it doesn't happen today, I don't care, because it'll happen eventually. But the only way it'll happen eventually is if I do everything in my power to make it today. So that's how I play better players. I die trying to win and take out every ball I can. Well, not at all caring if it actually is today or not, because I know my success is inevitable, because I trust my commander, because I have a foolproof plan with a goal that's realistic but still exciting, and I just want to keep swinging the bat until I get there. So that is how the relationship between the commander and the soldier needs to function. There needs to be a lot of trust, realism on the part of the commander, good strategy, and then good faith and trust on the soldier's part. And that's how you can use that to navigate through situations and sink other people. So a lot can be said more about this. I'm sure I'll talk about other mental game stuff. If you have questions, email me, info@mnpoolbootcamp.com. For now, I will say thank you for supporting the podcast, and hope you give your soldier every opportunity to have a fun next battle. Take care.
So that's another great one, Demetrius. And with that, that'll wrap up the podcast for another week. Thank you, fellas, for joining me. And it's always a pleasure getting to chat with you for our weekly meeting.
Outstanding, guys. Rob, Nate, fun conversation. A great question tonight. I really enjoyed it. Thanks, Rob.
Yeah, I learned something from asking that question, which I figured I would. So thank you, guys.
Yep. And that's a great segue maybe to saying get your questions in if you want to learn some stuff about other things too, because we could have some really good, fun, in-depth conversations on them. So listeners, reach out with your questions, and we will basically have full discussions on them just like that. So with that.
And then you get your name mentioned on the podcast.
Yeah, too. Of course. You get your 3 seconds of fame to all 7 listeners that listen to this podcast regularly. How exciting. Well, I guess take care, fellas. Till next week.
Okay. Adios, gentlemen.
Till next time. Be well. Thanks for coming to my party. Now that we're all out to broke, it's time to go home.